You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway.
You're listening to the Producer's Perspective Podcast with your host, Tony Award winner, Ken Davenport.
No one likes to have an empty seat, but that's especially true at the beginning of a run when you're trying to jumpstart that word of mouth. Well, if you're looking to make sure every seat in your house is filled, then check out the site theaterextras.com, perfect for producers or venue managers who want to make sure they have a butt in every single seat. Or if you're looking to be one of those people that fill those seats, check out theaterextras.com. That's theater with an E-R, extras.com.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFF's creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFF's The Original New Musical from Shayna Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Ken Davenport here. You're listening to the Producer's Perspective podcast. My guest on today's podcast is none other than Tony Award winner Richard Maltby. Welcome, Richard.
Well, nice to be here.
So Richard won that Tony for his direction of Ain't Misbehavin', which he also conceived as well. He's had a very varied career, winning many, many hats, from director to book writer to lyricist. Directed and wrote the lyrics for Big, directed Song and Dance, wrote the lyrics for Nick and Nora, lyrics for Miss Saigon, created and directed Fosse and Ring of Fire, book and lyrics for Pirate Queen, and lots more, including the review Closer Than Ever, which is where I first fell in love with your work. And this interesting known fact, he conceived and directed the only two musical reviews to win the Tony Award for Best Musical, Ain't Misbehavin' and Fosse.
I know. I thought that was kind of an interesting statistic.
Yeah,
so only two have won, and I've directed both of them.
So let's start
what
there.
What do you know?
Let's start there, then. Why do you think that is?
Why am I the king of reviews?
Yes.
I am the king of reviews because I don't like reviews. I don't. The standard review that used to be a song, a comedy song, a ballad, a sketch, a comedy song, you know, that sort of thing, or some kind of evening in which there was a compere of some sort, some, you know, a host who would sort of introduce the song and introduce. I thought that was just theatrically boring, and so when Lynn Meadow, who was the head of the Manhattan Theater Club, who I knew because at 12 years old, she was in the chorus of a musical that David Shire and I wrote at Yale. And we had a chorus of school kids in one number, and she was in it. And I'm afraid it changed her life. And so when she graduated from the drama school, she came in and was offered the Manhattan Theater Club, then a failing idea. That didn't have any life and nobody wanted it. She said, well, I'll take it. It's a theater in New York. I got it. And she was having some trouble, getting it going. And I did some benefits for her and everything. And there was this sort of restaurant space, this bar, and she wanted to make it into some kind of cabaret space and didn't know whether or not it could have anything in there, could have any kind of artistic content. And she suggested that David and I do a review of our songs. We decided to do it. I mean, a lot of them were songs from shows that had failed, and so, you know, things that had never been performed, and little numbers in reviews and things like that. And I said yes. So I had this body of songs, and I didn't quite know what to do. I just knew that I didn't want to have it I didn't want a narration. And so when we started to stage it, I had them sing the opening number, and I didn't know what to do, and I didn't sing it again, and I didn't know what to do, and I did this about 12 times and just sing it again. I really didn't know what to do. And finally, just to help me, it was two girls and one guy. The guy went to one of the girls and started to sing to her, and I thought, why didn't he go to the other one? I thought, oh God, I've got a plot. So I put together the first six songs as a kind of a story of a guy involved with two girls, just going song to song to song, and you kind of follow the story. So you were following a story. It was a review. It was just a collection of songs, but you were following a story. And so I sort of accidentally invented the bookless book musical. And a year later, that show was successful and moved, you know, off Broadway and ran for a year. And Lynn said, well, I have an open space again. You were talking about liking all those Fats Waller songs. Would you like, why don't you make some kind of cabaret evening out of that? I thought, oh, okay, all right. So, you know, we went into rehearsal. It's a kind of great trajectory. We went into rehearsal on January 1st. Of 1978. We opened on February 1st. We closed on March 1st. On April 1st, we went into rehearsal for Broadway. On May 1st, we opened at Broadway. And on June 1st, we won every award you can win in New York. And I thought that's what Broadway was. You open the show and everybody says fabulous things about you.
That was your Broadway debut.
That was my Broadway debut. I'd never done a Broadway show. It happened, you know, within 6 months. And then a year later, I had five productions of Miss Behaven all over the country touring. So it was kind of mind blowing. But again, Ain't Miss Behaven, it has no story yet. It has all the elements of story. I've been working with a book musical of Fats Waller's life with Murray Horowitz, whose idea it was. Fats Waller just had a really fabulous first act and no second act because he died too young. So we kind of abandoned it. But I took all the research and sort of shoved it into this review. So even though it's a review, it's one song after another, you know all about where he came from, you know who he is, you know his life philosophy, you know what kind of person he was, you know where he performed, you know the world that he had to deal with as a black artist in Harlem in the 20s and 30s, a hostile world in which the only way that you could survive was simply be so good that nobody couldn't ignore you, and as the show shaped itself, it has the trajectory of a dramatic piece. The performers are not playing themselves; they are playing characters. They are characters who do not have consistency. They don't have plots, but they have backstories. So what is that? That's a play. It just doesn't have a plot. Once again, I invented this thing. And I think the only reason I did it was that I didn't like reviews. So it didn't for a review to mean something to me, it has to have all of the things that make you, you know, go to a play or a musical. Bigger reverberations, bigger meaning, some sort of context that's bigger than the play, than the story itself. So I just, you know, I also, and I realize I also had sort of invented the jukebox musical, for which I should be, you know, pilloried, not given the Tony Award. But anyway, there it is.
Well, let's go back to this, the review, and because every focus group that I go to, of course, what one of the things we always hear is we want a story, we want a story, we want a story. And you found a way to do that without doing it. And I remember the liner notes for Closer Than Ever that I studied when I was, when I was singing What Am I Doing as an audition tune, or 16 bars of it anyway, not very well. I remember you saying, or the liner notes talking about, we had these story songs, story songs, story songs, which we're able to make this evening. So my question is, can any composer, lyricist, team have a review, or is it, does it have to be a specific type of song? Or could you take any pop artist now and say, oh, I can add story to it, or does it have to be inherent to the material?
Well, I mean, the answer to the question is any of those things are possible, depending on the nature of the songs. There are certain songs that are dramatic. Some are pop. Some of the great pop songs are dramatic. Billy Joel tends to write theater songs. Those songs go on the stage real easily. Some of them really have characters. Some of them have plots. Some of them have stories. But some others, are just pop songs, and those songs have a hard time, finding a life on the stage. You can use a song that doesn't have a story in it, in a storytelling way, and get away with it sometimes. With Closer Than Ever, those were real character songs. There was a real person. You introduced a person, the person told you a story or her story, and by the end you pretty much knew everything you needed to know about that story. That was inherently theater. I mean, the difference being that in Closer Than Ever, the four people playing it can't be the same character. You can't take the information from this song and apply it to the next song you sing. They had to be different people as they came out, even though they didn't change their costume or anything like that. But you couldn't attach them into some form that made a plot out of them. So the answer to that question is it depends on the nature of the songs or the nature of the show that you're doing. You can fit a undramatic song into an evening by making it serve a plot point, but it's not easy. But you can get away with it. If you don't make it serve a plot point, then you're just doing a concert, and there's nothing wrong with a concert. Come out and do 18 great songs. I'm a happy camper. It's just, theater is a story.
So we brushed over the beginning of your career. We went straight to winning that Tony Award, frankly. But
so do I. As far as I'm concerned, everything that happened before that.
Well, tell me a little bit about how you found the theater to begin with and why you chose to write and direct for the theater.
Well, I don't know. My father was a musical arranger and orchestrator and ultimately a band leader. My mother trained as a ballerina and sort of gave it up. But so I started with that. And, that was somewhere in my genes. And I wanted to be a set designer, and what I really wanted to do was design scenery for Radio City Music Hall stage shows. That was my goal in life.
That's pretty specific.
I just loved the Radio City Music Hall. My father arranged an Easter show one year, and so I went in and saw the dress rehearsal. In those days, the Radio City Music Hall did 4 stage shows and 5 movies every day, and they did it every day, which meant that when the show changed, they did their final show at 9:30 at night, and the new show at 10:30 the next morning. Scenery changed, everything changed. So the Rockettes would rehearse at 3 in the morning, and the Court of LA would rehearse at 4 in the morning, and they'd do a dress rehearsal at at 8:30, and they'd open the house at 9:30, because that was what I saw. I must say, the thing that killed me was that I saw the dress rehearsal. And then they pad the show on the first day. They have some extra short subjects, and then they showed the movie, and then they did the stage show. And they had rewritten it. It wasn't the same. My little 10-year-old, 12-year-old brain just exploded. I couldn't believe they would rewrite it between 8:30 and 10:30. Of course, nowadays, what they did was they rewrote the opening speech, which was like 30 seconds long, and probably wasn't a big deal. But for me, it was like rewriting the whole show. So that's what I wanted to do. Oh, I get a review of some sort in my little grade school in Syos on Long Island. I then went to prep school in New Hampshire, and I wrote a musical in my senior year there. I, you know, scandalized the school by doing a musical. The whorehouse.
Totally original musical.
Yeah, it was. And
was it good?
It was, well, considering that there was no reason for its existence, it wasn't terrible.
Did you write the music as well?
I co-wrote the book and I wrote the lyrics. That was the beginning of the end for me, because I could always get somebody to write the music, and I could sometimes get somebody to write the script or the story, but no one ever wanted to write the lyrics, so I always ended up writing the lyrics, and that is how I became a lyricist.
Just because no one else would do it.
Nobody else wanted to do it. And so I then went to Yale, and I met David Shire in our freshman year, and in our sophomore, in our junior and senior year, we wrote original musicals. First one, an adaptation of Cyrano de Bergerac. God. The most elaborate costumed show, you know, period in history. And we had no budget, but we just did it. I mean, we just did it. And the next year, we wrote another one. And then we came to New York after a little bit of, both of us spent a semester in grad school, and then we came to New York. And I suddenly said, well, I'm a lyricist. What am I doing being a lyricist? The last thing I want to be is a lyricist. First of all, you have no fun. Everybody is at the theater having a good time, and you're home in the hotel trying to fix those two bad lines. And which, if you had any intelligence, you would have written them good in the first place. If you knew how to write them, you would have written them in the first place. And so you're slogging away at it. And it was very disconcerting. Plus, when directors were sort of dealing with our material, they tended to not direct them very well, and in fact do worse than that. Sometimes they actually did things that undercut what the song was about. So slowly I came around to the realization that what I really wanted to do was to create the show, not just write the lyrics, and that sort of meant I really wanted to direct the show. And, so that started me on the course to that. I sort of said to myself, well, I have other people studied directing in school. Other people have been directing shows for, you know, 5 years. I haven't done that. I'm so far behind. How can I possibly think of doing this? And then I thought, well, how bad could I be? Could I be worse than any of the directors who I worked with? This is a piece of cake. So I spent a long time just doing, I did nightclub acts, I did benefits, I did one-man shows, I did shows that I is invented so that I could direct them in small places and everything. And that led me to some performers, and I got to direct some plays. And it's funnily enough, since all I know is musicals, the first play I was offered to direct was Long Day's Journey Tonight, the longest, most non-musical thing there is. It has I know, you know, light cues and theatricality. It's a play in which the lights go on at the beginning of the act, and maybe at the end of the act, they go off.
Yeah, I always, whenever I run into a stage manager who tells me they're stage managing Long Day's Journey into Night, I always have lots of pity for them as they just sit there and call three cues.
I know. The fog comes in the second act. That's the big cue.
So let me ask you, there's a trend emerging in your career. I'm sensing already. Number one, you didn't know how to write lyrics. You just felt, I'm going to write lyrics. You didn't know how to create a review. You created a review. Directing, well, I just might as well. You just tend to do things, even though you haven't done them before. What gave you the courage that you could do those things?
Well, what else is there? I mean, I guess the impulse to the first process of creating something like that is you have to see it in your head. You know, I guess I thought theatrically. I thought of shows as things that I could like see, and therefore creating them, writing them, was a sort of a technical thing to do to make it come to life. Hiring actors, talking to actors, all those things were just are the things you do to get the show to happen. And you can write an outline, you can even write a script, but nobody really knows what it is unless you do it. And so I just sort of did it. And I did a musical review in eighth grade. I mean, in a school, but had no theatrical anything. I mean, we did a Abe Lincoln pageant at one point, and that, you know, it was silly. But I sort of got the. I just started out by doing, and it never occurred to me that that wasn't a thing to do.
And when you got towards the bigger stages and all of a sudden people started chiming in with feedback, including places like the New York Times or other, did that affect you at all? Do you read reviews?
Well, I certainly read the reviews for Amos Behaven. I mean, there wasn't a bad sentence in about 100 reviews all around the country. And you know what? That isn't the way it always works.
I've heard this recently, in fact.
You may not know that, but they actually don't always say nice things about you. So at any rate, that I suddenly, you know, I went from having, you know, an off-Broadway review, and I had a kind of reputation as a bright songwriter, but nothing of any major significance. And then I just had this blockbuster hit, so. But from then on, we just, it was easier to roll on after that.
And what happened when the first show that you did, we can't all have big, fat, global sensations like you did on your
you
first.
Can't?
No, unfortunately not. No. I'm sorry to have to school you on this, Richard, but that's the way it is.
Oh, my God, that's shocking.
I know. What happens when that occurs in your career? Was it a shock to you when something didn't go that way? And how did you pick yourself up and go on to the next?
Well, the next show that I did was Baby, which was extremely, you know, personal. David and I wrote it with Sybil Pearson, who came in to write the book. The songs were very much out of our experience and our life. The show got very nice reviews, not exactly money reviews, but a range of extremely, you know, positive reviews, particularly for the score. And it did well. I mean, we were sort of scrapped, considering we had no stars and no anything, you know, going for us. We were around for almost a year, and every day we wondered whether enough people would come to the theater to keep us open for another day, and they did. We kept going. We had a little bit of a sinking fund that kept us going, and so that was not. I have not been told to get out of town yet.
And that show specifically is done all over the place.
Yeah, I would assume. I mean, as soon as you record a show and it's got a good score, you know, it goes off and takes on a life of its own, you know, closer than ever. I didn't know it was again a show that was downtown, and we were not sure that it was ever going to get through this week to the next week. But the album had gone off into all the colleges. Every theater program kid was going crazy for this album. I didn't know it. We didn't know it. I didn't know it until we did the revival 10, 20 years later. And then all those performers who were now almost 40 came and said, "You changed my life. My God, you can't believe it."
I had that recording myself. And it's interesting you say this about the college kids, because I was one of those college kids. And then, you know, we had Pasek and Paul on the podcast.
Yes.
And they talk about how college kids got a hold of their music. And now just Joe Iconis was on last week talking about how kids... Are kids really responsible for the proliferation of new composer lyricists out there? Is this the early adopters for us?
Well, I think they are now. I mean, Closer Than Ever was 91, and Pasek and Paul are a great deal, you know, more recent than that, and Joe Iconis is the same thing. I think there are phenomena that come along, and there is one right now, which is, ever since, it's been growing and growing, ever since High School Musical and then Glee and then all of the, it suddenly become acceptable to be interested in musical theater. The football player can in fact come in and play Curly in the school production book and not be considered something that, not be laughed at. And so, that's happened. And there's a great, great school of a great quantity of people. Of kids who are interested in the theater, and they're encouraged. It's not a peripheral the way it used to be. Plus, I mean, there used to be like four colleges that had theater programs, musical theater programs. Now there are 100 colleges that have, every one of them has a music, and they're all turning out talented, gifted kids who come to New York for the same number of parts, you know, and everything else. But they're turning out writers and everything else. So the theater has always the theater's audience, generally speaking, was a grown up audience. All of the great musicals, the kids did not go to them. I mean, the kids went and sat in the second balcony and had their life changed and all of that stuff. But the shows were essentially for grown-ups. That was the audience. And it still is that. And musical theater is also a little stuffy. We have not really embraced modern musical forms. And now we have, there are generations of kids who have grown up who don't know what My Fair Lady is. I mean, as far as that's, you could be talking about The Merry Widow. I mean, it's like, but they totally know Bruno Mars and pop artists do unbelievable shows. These arena shows are just, they're Broadway musicals. I mean, they have scenery, they have dancers, they tell stories, because the artists usually shape their evening to have a kind of a storytelling content. So it's not a big deal for that to come in. Pasek and Paul are a perfect example of that. They are extremely smart about the history of musical theater, but their foot is definitely in the modern world. So when they do The Greatest Showman, this is a show set in the past with the number staged like Bruno Mars videos. I mean, that the dance style is not you standard Broadway dancing. It's hip hop dancing. What's that doing in a period show? Well, why not? I mean, that we've always used musical theater's always used a foreign has used an anachronistic musical style. The pop songs in Oklahoma are not what anybody would have sung in Oklahoma in the period of the show. But that's what it is. So in a way, the kids are ahead of us. They're really saying, bring this into the theater. Shows should have this kind of excitement. The other style gets to be a little stuffy, gets to be a little dull. Shows are getting a lot more exciting. Dearman Hansen is brilliant. By the way, Basil and Paul, when they were in college, didn't know quite what to do. And they listened to Closer Than Ever and realized that you could have a show that didn't have a book and you could fill up an evening. So I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, that was this review called Edges, which landed on my desk. I'm really just thinking about this now because, of course, Jason Robert Brown had a very similar thing with Songs from a New World.
I bumped into him in a laundromat in the village, and we were both picking up our laundry, and he introduced himself, and he wanted to write Closer Than Ever. Songs from a New World is his Closer Than Ever in exactly the same way.
You talked about the audience for Broadway being a little older and stuffier. Do you think an emerging musical theater composing lyricist team should write for that audience? Should they think, oh, I have an idea that will work for that crowd so I can be successful?
The rules of entertainment don't change. You know, the rules of grabbing you with an idea, having a melody you want to hear, and how you develop it, those rules remain the same, whether it's in a hip-hop vernacular or whether it's in a Rodgers and Hammerstein vernacular. The rest is just sort of, you know, tree trimming. The biggest shows out there right now are incredibly fresh. Could not have been written, you know. Hamilton is, of course, the prime example of an actual, hip-hop musical, except that Lin-Manuel totally understands the history and the shape of conventional musical theater and delivers on that level totally. It is if there weren't hip-hop rhythms, that show would play in exactly the same way. And it just happened that he had a vision that the founding fathers of Hamilton in particular were the equivalent of rap artists. And he followed it through all the way to the end and created an earth-shaking work of art. Dear Evan Hansen is the same thing, although it's actually a conventionally structured story. Come From Away is not a rock show in any way, but it's structured like no show I've ever seen. It's basically a narrative sentence. It's an expository sentence. It's a paragraph with songs in it. I want to tell you about what happened in Newfoundland. Matilda is one, Groundhog Day is one, Joe Iconis is going to have finally his big breakthrough with a show that the kids would not let go. I just talked to friends of my grandson who came down to see Be More Chill. As soon as the show was announced, they got on the phone and they bought tickets, even though it was like for 6 months from now, And I asked him where they got how they heard about the show. And he said, well, somebody called me up and said, you've got to hear this. And another one said, well, I was just looking at new things, and there was a show I didn't know, so I started listening to it, and I thought that was terrific. So, yes, there are kids going out and doing it. And when they do it, they become rabid. They also said, we're going to see. I said, well, we'll meet after the show. And they said, well, we'll see the show, and then we're going to go stage dooring, which was a new noun I had never heard. But apparently, kids, it's a word, which is we go and hang out in the stage door and get autographs.
Yeah, it's so funny. I used to do this too, and I was all alone. It was just me, nobody else. I missed Saigon, for God's sakes. I did it.
People would do that, and there'd be like five people outside the door. And now it's actually part of the process. I think it's because of the ticket prices. You spend that amount of money, you had better have your life changed for all time, and you don't want it to go away. So you hang out and say hello to people and put in work.
Can we talk a little bit about your work on Saigon and how that happened and your work on a big musical coming in from overseas?
Yeah, I'm sure. I just came from Providence, where the national company just went together. It is so good. Oh my God, the production is just breathtaking. It's so rich and a young cast that just gives their heart to it. It's great. Let's see. I had done Baby, which has some pretty elaborate and impressive lyrics, and somewhere that was like 83, 85, I guess, was when Les Mis opened, and after Les Mis opened, Alain Boublil, Michel Schoenberg had this other idea based upon a photograph they had seen. Claude Michel had seen this photograph of a Vietnamese woman giving her child to American soldiers so that the child would be raised in America. A child that she had had by an American soldier, that she was, and he thought that was heartbreaking. And from that, they sort of added pieces of Madame Butterfly and laid out the show. They write in French, and they did finish the whole first act. And it was Cameron McIntosh, who decided that this show needed an American writer, needed an American presence. It wasn't a European show the way that Les Mis was. Herbie Kretzmer, who had written all of the Aznavour lyrics, who was a wonderful writer, but Cameron thought it needs an American writer. He was completely right, because all of the Europeans literally didn't know what Vietnam meant to America. It didn't just mean that we, it was a disaster for us and we lost the war, but it was the end of an American mythology built in the Second World War. We are the good guys. John Wayne comes over the hill and saves the day, and we win the war. Vietnam, we were the bad guys. John Wayne did not come over the hill, and we lost. And with that went something that we all needed to believe that we were. And I think the Europeans' attitude was, we've been losing colonies for 100 years. We gotta get off or come off of it. Yeah, that's the big deal. But it was not so much a tragedy, a physical, historical tragedy, but the end of a mythology. I mean, America is two things. It is what it is, and it is its mythology. The American dream, which is the sort of central image of the show. We had lots and lots of talks about Alain growing up in Algeria, and moving to Italy, and then moving to France. Claude Michel and growing up in Vienna, and moving to France, and then to England. They from their childhood, the fantasy of what America was gigantic. And everybody we talked to, there was always this, no matter, I mean, you could be the worst hater of America. You could be completely anti-American, but the American dream was a vivid and positive and glowing. And that seems, at least it seemed when we were writing it then, to be universal. I don't know whether it's true now, but it was then. And so that was like part of I don't know that they would have come to that on their own without an American writer who could have brought that sensibility to the show. The show was brilliantly laid out in terms of scenes and everything, but it wasn't, it wasn't written as a play, really. And so what Bublé and I did was we would go to a hotel and spend 3 weeks there and write half of the first act. And then send it off, and then I'd forget about it for 2 months, and then we'd get another call to come back and finish the second act. So it was it was the best collaborative experience I've had all the way down the line. The brilliant director, Nick Heitner, on the show. Cameron at his absolute best. It was so on the money all the way through it. I will say that when Cameron called and asked me to do it, he sent me this tape that Claude Michel had made, which was the entire first act, Claude Michel playing at the piano and him singing it in French. I did not know what it was. It had these pretty melodies, and then it would have this strange recitative sections. And also, that was like 85, 10 years after Vietnam. And in the 10 years since 75, every novel, movie, and play, or anything about Vietnam failed. America simply didn't want to think about it. And so I turned it down. then I saw Les Mis, and I realized, oh, that's recitative, that's storytelling recitative. I get what that is. And Platoon opened and was a huge hit, and I realized, oh, maybe we are now ready to look at Vietnam. So I called Cameron back and said, have you hired anybody? And he said, no, we were waiting for you, Richard. It's not true, but I liked the idea. So I met Claude Michel, and we went to work.
Do you have a favorite lyric of yours that you've written?
Well, I think the lyric for If I Sing from Closer Than Ever is that's about my father and about David's father. We both are sons of musicians, orchestra leaders, and so that would be part of it. And I guess the other is The Story Goes On from the end of the first act, The Baby. I like it when we write a song that is about something that no one has ever written a song about. You know, no one's ever quite captured that emotion. I think that's the goal, or at least that's what I'd like it to be. And both of those songs are that.
Is there, as you listen to new writers coming up, or frankly even veteran writers, what's the most common, we'll use mistake, for lack of a better word, that you feel writers make?
Not really going deeply enough into themselves. Genuine emotions are often contradictory, unexpected, sometimes unpleasant, sometimes. But we always know when we're hearing it, it's got the ring of truth. It could be the blandest thought in the world. I mean, it could be this nearly was mine from South Pacific, just as simple as anything, or as complicated as no words, at the end of Dear Evan Hansen, or anything that's in Hamilton. But if you go into your heart, you come in and you really are using your personal knowledge of humankind. The song takes on a kind of, you recognize its truth, you recognize its life, and that is that is always thrilling. And I would say whenever I like am asked to judge a class or something like that, the question that always, the thing I always say is, where are you in this? It's clever. I don't know where it's coming from. It's like it's an imitation of some, it's of an emotion that you think you ought to have. When Sheldon Harnick wrote, "My teeth ache from the urge to touch you." That's an unspeakable truth,
Okay, my last question, which is my genie question. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to visit you and wants to thank you for your contributions to the American musical theater by granting you one wish. What's the one thing about Broadway that drives you crazy, nuts, gets you super mad, that you'd want this genie to wish away in an instant? The most frustrating thing about our business.
Well, that's really, there are so many. The thought that's in my mind that I'm having trouble expressing is the reading process. I call it death by reading. As soon as you have something that seems to be kind of complete, we have a reading. Readings are incredibly misleading. I mean, they're very hard to tell what you've got. They can tell you big, bold problems. I lose you here or I lose you there. That they're very useful. But we all know that something that plays well in a reading, you put it on the stage and suddenly everything changes. It's hard to imagine that Gypsy was written in 9 months or that they got the idea to do South Pacific. And the first thing they did was call up Boston and book the theater. I mean, really? And they just wrote it and it went out of town. Kiss Me, Kate went to Philadelphia and they didn't change anything. The only thing they did was that Cole Porter stood in the wings and handed Lisa Kirk extra verses to Always True to You, Darling, in My Fashion, because it was such a hit. I guess those days are gone because you couldn't possibly get a show on the basis of it just having been written. It's too scary and it's too expensive. I guess if I'm... The other thing is, I just wish they weren't so expensive. Broadway used to be the creative cauldron. That's where the creativity was happening. Now you have to go somewhere else and try it out. And sometimes the process of bringing the show in, by the time it comes in, has been worked over and so thought over, and kind of some of its life goes out of it. Whereas it used to have a kind of, a buoyancy. The other thing was that in those days, in the classic musical days, all of those people learned. They had conventional storytelling, playwriting skills that came from the 20s and the 30s. The well-made play, they were playwright craftsmen. They all knew what a story was and they knew how to do it. Younger writers don't have that craft and have to learn it. They can learn it. They do learn it. Basic and Paul certainly learned it. Edwin certainly learned it. It can be learned, but the process of development can take the life out of things. It's also true that some of the people who are producing shows don't know a story if it kissed them on the mouth, and they don't know, and they're likely to encourage things that shouldn't be encouraged and not and discourage things that are fresh and strong. I have certainly been around that. And the things that they're never stupid, they're really smart. They're smart, but you shouldn't pay attention.
A very interesting answer.
That was a lot of answers to one simple question.
And all of them
this
fascinating.
This gene is going to be exhausted.
I just love the idea of what if we could decide, you and I, write a show right now, open it in 9 months, and then try to do the same thing, but with 3 months and compare, 3 years and compare to see which one was actually better.
I know.
I'd bet money on the 9 months. There's something about a deadline.
Well, it depends on the show. Depends on, I thought, because I think Dear Evan Hansen is just really, really terrific. It reads and seems like they got this idea. They sat down and wrote it in one piece, and there it is. It was an 8-year gestation period that started out as a show totally different from the one that they ended up with.
Yeah, I was at one of those early workshops, and one of the things I loved, and I've said to Stacey and to the guys, I've amazed at the work that they did from that first workshop to there.
It's so incredibly smart. I mean, they were so smart to follow it through. They were really lucky in their bringing Steve Levinson in, who really, and I don't know where he got his expertise from, but he solidly knew what a story was. Michael Greif added another completely solid level of the same thing. And the show turned into something else. And then, of course, Ben Platt's performance didn't hurt. Having a completely historic event happen. But those things happen. You when the show is right, you get presents. Things come along to make you, there are times when you sit back and just watch the miracle happen. And you set it in motion. Amos Payne was that. I did all the pieces of it and everything. And then when we first hit an audience and the audience went crazy, I kind of went, oh, okay. I did all of that. Yet I didn't do that.
When it all comes together, there's just nothing better.
I know. I always say it's a humiliating, depressing, discouraging process and the most fun you'll ever have.
And with that, I thank you for joining us and having fun with us today. Thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.